Follow the White Rabbit is a game that will teach you practical politics. Practical politics is called practical politics because it is non-voting, which makes it very, very practical. Conventional politics is, of course, rule-based politics, which is what you do at the voting booth. It's very, very rule-based and timeline-based, you know, every 4 years, every 2 years, so on and so forth. And full-spectrum practical politics is engaging and taking out an opponent or a system or a corporation, so on and so forth, by any means necessary under the rules or under the laws, but never breaking the rules or never breaking the laws. But to understand anything, we first have to teach you practical politics, which is non-voting politics. The first basics are the art of staying on point or using a talking point and being able to say it over and over again to make your point, not arguing, just making a point. But this is an introduction, again, to Follow the White Rabbit, and Follow the White Rabbit is a game that will teach you practical politics. It rouses in us the yearning to see the end. The final crash that will push into oblivion both those worthless isms that are a product of the decay of thought and of character, and the no less worthless religions of equality which have slowly prepared the ground for them. The coming of the Kauki, the divine destroyer of evil, the dawn of a new cycle opening, as all time cycles ever did, with a golden age. Never mind how bloody the final crash may be. Never mind what old treasures may perish forever in the redeeming conflagration. The sooner it comes, the better. We are waiting for it, for the following glory, confident in the divinely established cyclical law that governs all manifestations of existence and time, the law of eternal return. We are waiting for it, for the subsequent triumph of the truth, persecuted today, for the triumph under whatever name, of the only faith in harmony with the everlasting laws of being, of the only modern ism which is anything but modern, being just the latest expression of principles as old as the sun. The triumph of all those men who throughout the centuries and today have never lost the vision of the everlasting order, decreed by the sun, who have fought in selfless spirit to impress the vision upon others. We are waiting for glorious restoration, this time on a worldwide scale, of a new order, projection in time, in the next, as in every recurring golden age, of the everlasting order of the cosmos. It is the only thing worth living for and dying for, given that privilege. Savitri Devi wrote that in 1948. I was asked if I've ever read The Lightning of the Sun. Yes, but it's been a long time, and thank you for sending that to me, because it's probably better work on cycles, more relevant now than it was then, although I don't agree with all of it. But yeah, I will read that, and thank you. She's talking about wordisms. That's our thing. So it's very good, and thank you for sending that to me. But in this question and answer, I'm going to go over, a little bit deeper into the Joseph P. Farrell type topics, and I'm going to answer probably about 50 to 70 questions in the course of the next hour and 20. And this is mostly for the conspiracy-minded White Rabbits, the new listeners that have asked questions. I'm not going to answer the questions on a one by one basis. I'm just going to answer them all at once by doing things my way or talking directly. But this should answer their questions. And this is going to be two parts. There's going to be another part that I'm going to answer other questions, which are a little bit shorter and easier to get to. But this is part one, and we're going to go into Joseph P. Farrell, and I'm going to talk about some things that he's alluding to. And I'm going to go deeper down that line for these conspiracy White Rabbits. And in part two, this is 34, and 35 is going to be part two. I'm going to go into 9/11. I was asked questions about that. I'm going to go into some other things as well in 35, but this is 34. This is back into Joseph P. Farrell, who is my go-to source for anything like anything having to do with anything conspiratorial, believe it or not, because he's the one talking, and he's also well-sourced, and he's got the credentials and that type of thing that I would look for in someone like him. But we're going to go back into this topic, and we'll begin that right now. I've got a lot of questions from the conspiracy White Rabbits. Some conspiracy-minded White Rabbits are writing me. And I wanted to answer some of their questions, so I'm going to do that. And it may take a couple MP3s, and some of the other listeners might find this stuff interesting. Others may not. I don't know, but I will answer them just like I do everyone else. Excuse me, for better or worse. But I've been asked about Joseph P. Farrell because he's become Dr. Farrell has become a rising star in that community. for setting the world on fire. I asked about how I found him and what was the first book I've read and stuff like that. And I will go over that. I've talked before that Russian TV had picked up Richard Hoagland, and Hoagland, H-O-A-G-L-A-N-D, Dick Hoagland, is someone that, you know, and passing by, I'm sure you've heard of. He's the one that talked about faces on Mars and stuff like that. The challenge for me, when it comes to Richard, I don't see faces on Mars. Not to say they're not there. I don't know. But I don't see anything those guys see. I don't have their particular skill sets either. But anyways, the Russians have always been fascinated by Hoagland, which kind of puts me up in arms, you know. The Russians are very fascinated by this guy, and they put him on Russian TV quite a bit. And over the past 5-6 years, it's been with increasing frequency. Maybe even more than that, longer than that. But one of these times, they talked about Joseph P. Farrell, and there was a connection between Hoagland and Farrell. Not that they agree on everything, but Joseph P. Farrell is kind of like Dick Hoagland's go-to guy when it comes to provocative conspiracy theories involving anything National Socialist out of World War II, which is interesting in itself. But that's how he came up. And at the time, I had heard of Dr. Farrell. I had a book called Reich of the Black Sun, which is his first book. I had not read the book. I was told to read the book because of something he's implying in the book. But I assumed I knew what it was. Here's another Oxford PhD. The guy's very smart. There's all kinds of them out there writing about Nazis, and he's going to give me a bunch of smoke and mirrors or a bunch of nonsense, a bunch of stuff that I don't need to deal with, because none of them treat it fairly. Well, in all fairness, I hadn't read the book, and so I was looking at the title, Reich of the Black Sun. And Dr. Farrell is a very odd person, and also the publishers on Ventures Unlimited Press. If you look up at Ventures Unlimited Press, that is not a place Horace C. Venger, yours truly, would ever buy a book from, because most of the stuff does not have sources revealed. It's just a bunch of pie-in-the-sky stuff. In all fairness, I've never read everything from there. That's my bias against that place. It's a bunch of crazy books, as I would say. So there's two things going wrong for him. He's the title, and in all fairness, he didn't title it. For them to publish his stuff, I would find out later, they put all these wild titles on it. That's what they do, I guess. So you have a few things going on here. You have an Oxford PhD. I'm looking at the book title. I didn't want to read it because I assumed I knew what it was about. And he's published by Ventures Unlimited Press. And in all fairness to him, that's the only ones that would publish multiple books from someone like him. Because at the time he proposed a multiple book series. He proposes to other people too, and they wouldn't have anything to do with it. Because they actually, they did what I didn't do. They actually read his stuff. They were reading where this guy was going and his credentials to go where he was going to go. He's got some serious credentials when it comes to ancient languages and different stuff related to stuff that predates the Bible as well as the Bible, and we'll get back to this. So I'm looking at the book cover, and I have biases, and I didn't read it. I put it aside. I didn't have time for it that day, and this went by a while. And then he was on, it came up that Hoagland was again on Russian TV, and what crazy stuff are they talking about? When it comes to space program, I pay attention because the Russians work with NASA, and the Russian space program has always worked with NASA, and I pay attention to all those connections, as any listener of mine would know. But then I got asked, did I read Farrell's stuff? And I said, no, but they're mentioning him on Russian TV, and they're like, you didn't read Dr. Farrell's stuff. You didn't read Reich of the Black Sun. I'm like, I just assume he's another PhD from Oxford writing about Nazis, but he's not doing anything fairly. Like, did you read it? Well, no. So I'm shooting off my mouth. What happens to white rabbits, all white rabbits? We get put to sleep on a topic, and then someone comes up and just hammers you with a big root vegetable. And so then I picked up Reich of the Black Sun. I'm reading it, and I was told to point to Roswell, where he's talking about Roswell, and look at his logic behind it. And Roswell, New Mexico, in like 1946, is something every rabbit on this planet has heard about. Little green men landed at Roswell. Little green men coming down to visit us and give us technology and all this crazy stuff that comes out of it. Special after special on TV, little green men, fake photos, or real photos of little green men getting dissected. Everyone has heard this stuff. Well, I open up the book to Roswell. And I look at his logic. Now, first off, he doesn't start disputing the documents. His next book, in all fairness, he's going into some of the different documents, what's fake and what's real. He's saying, all right, I won't dispute you UFO junkies documents. I'll assume that Magic 12 documents, these documents from the government, they look like official government documents, by the way, to me. Not that I'm an expert on that, but I know a little about them. They're blacked out perfectly, and I mean, they look like they could be official government documents, but people assume that some elements of them are official. He's saying, let's assume they are official. Let's look in these and see what we see. And he does something extraordinary. He points out the obvious. And he's asking a question. He's pointing out the obvious. He's saying what is true here, and he's pointing out the obvious. And he does this brilliantly. And so immediately he has my attention. I'm like, well, this white rabbit's doing something about it. I mean, I've heard about this event. I'm not big on UFO topics. I don't ever watch the whole specials on them because I assume it's something the military's doing. If they're a little green men land, I guess I'll deal with that at the time. But until I see one, you know, I don't know. Nah, I mean, I know I don't see anything anyways, but I just always assume there's military playing around. But he's doing something fascinating in Reich of the Black Sun. In spite of the fact that it's his first go-round at this topic, in spite of the fact that he's way overqualified to be writing about this stuff, in spite of the fact that he's walking down an area that is verboten for most, he's playing it fair. And he's saying what is true here, and he's pointing out the obvious. But what he does is funny. He takes the government documents that all these UFO guys assume is real, and he says, fine, they're real. Let's look at this and see what we see. And so he pulls out, the first thing he pulls out are typewriter keys. He's saying, now wait a minute here. You know, they found typewriter keys at the crash site. You know, the government poses this crash, this famous UFO crash, as two a totally opposite hypothesis. They make two different cases. The first case they make is that it's ordinary and mundane. This technology is ordinary and mundane. It's the famous weather balloon. The second thing they propose is outstanding. It's extraordinary and extraterrestrial. And he's like, let's see what the problem is with both of these both these certainties the government goes through. There are two contradictions here. Well, the first thing he points out is they're finding typewriter keys, things that look like typewriter keys. Now he says, then he immediately points out something else from the crash records, right from the government documents. They found a book they believed to be a manual. Now, what are the odds of something extraterrestrial having typewriter keys and books? I mean, typewriter keys sound terrestrial, and books sound terrestrial. Not only that, you're talking about a craft, and they say, well, this craft probably went 700 miles an hour. Well, now that's fast as anything for 1946, but is that fast enough to go jumping around the galaxy for little green men who are stopping at libraries in Texas, obviously, and at the local hardware store or local office supply to get them a typewriter? So he says, this is obviously terrestrial. You know, I mean, based on their, I mean, what are the odds of little green men? I mean, it's like Billy Bob walks over there, and he's looking at Billy Bob down in Texas, and Billy Bob walks over there, and he's like, don't mess with Texas, and there's some little green men here, but none of these people say that. They walk over and they say, well, we found some books and some metal, some fascinating memory like metal that springs back and forth, and we found books and things that look like typewriter keys. Well, if something's extraterrestrial, they're not going to have books. They're going to say, oh, we got some space-age techie thing, looks like maybe a manual. They're not going to have typewriter keys and books. So right away he catches my attention. I'm like, this guy's funny. He's saying to the UFO people, your little god doesn't exist. He may exist, but he doesn't exist in Roswell. No, they're little green men. But then he does something even more extraordinary. He says, well, let's look at... He says, well, let's look at what the little guys looked like that land. Well, how convenient. That's all blacked out. I mean, their whole entire description of the whatever wreck there, the actual beings, is blacked out. We don't know what they look like until 30 or 40 years later they tell us. Well, how convenient. Well, let's read about the technology. And so he's reading about the technology, and one thing becomes clear. They actually invited over German National Socialists, two-party members. Actual four Nazis show up. They're actual party members. Party members in Texas, Operation Paperclip. Some of them hadn't even been fully vetted. They're at camp down there. And they, like Arthur Rudolph and the famous Wernher von Braun, they invited them over. They're four Germans. I don't know the other two's name, but four Germans. And they said, take a look at this crash. I want to stop you there. Imagine the national security implications of just going to war with the Germans. You defeated the German army. You have Germans here on Operation Paperclip, actual Nazi party members, high-ranking scientists, so on and so forth, and now you've had the largest breach in the history of the world, definitely in the history of the United States, the largest security breach ever. You have little green men crashing, and you invite a former enemy who just a couple years ago were your enemy over to take a look? Does that make any sense? No! You would never do that. It's just a little violation of national security. You would never in a million years invite national socialists to look at little green men wrecking. But what's funny is what the government documents say the Germans say. Arthur Rudolph and von Braun. And they ask them, they're asking the Germans, what do you think this is? This is the government documents now. Okay, Germans, we know you're bad guys a couple years ago, and we know you're here on Operation Paperclip, but we need you to look at this because these are little green men who come zillions of light years flying 700 miles an hour to buy typewriters and check out books. We need you to look at this wreck and tell us what it is. What do you think it is in your opinion? They're like, well, it is obviously, this is what these texts say. I'm going to read to you exactly what these things say. It is obvious that what you're dealing with here is a neutronic engine that is based on a thermonuclear process, and it relies on a charge differential to set up a field, and that is how this thing moves and defies gravity, and so on and so forth. I'm like, whoa, and these are the actual government documents. He's not making this stuff up. How do they know that? How do these Germans know that? Where are they coming from that? Now, Wernher von Braun is very sophisticated. These guys are very sophisticated for 1946. I mean, but sophisticated at that time is liquid oxygen as a propellant and lighting off big bottle rockets. I'm sorry, V2s are state of the art. But they're not thermonuclear process, charge differential, all that stuff state of the art. This explanation they come up with that, oh, it's quite obvious that it's a neutronic engine, they're not used to dealing with stuff like that. They don't deal with stuff like that, according to any of their official records. Where are they coming from with this explanation in these documents? Where are the Nazis getting this? Well, common sense would dictate they've seen something like this before. You don't just come up with an answer like that. You're used to firing V2 rockets at England. You're used to, using liquid oxygen as propellant to fire your big sophisticated bottle rockets at people. You walk over and look at little green men crashing, and you say, well, it's obvious a neutronic engine based on a thermonuclear process that relies on charge differential to set up a field, and that's how it moves and defies gravity. You're not in any way, shape, manner, or form going to be able to come up with that explanation unless you've seen something like that before. That's kind of common sense. So what he does in this book is something that caught my fancy right away. He takes an event that we've all seen, that I'm not an expert on, I'm not really interested in that, and he makes me interested in it. He reads exactly what they're looking at, he asks the question, what is true here, and he points out the obvious, that clearly the Germans were far more sophisticated than we knew. We knew they were sophisticated when it comes to V2 rockets, but clearly these guys know a whole hell of a lot more than just liquid oxygen. Where could they come up with this explanation? Even if the documents are fraudulent, how would they get this explanation? Because apparently this is engineerable. Where are they getting this at? And so the two conclusions he comes up with is, one, the only honest conclusion is that the Germans were far more sophisticated. I think we can all agree on that. I don't think anyone doubts that nowadays. But he comes up with two conclusions. That one, that when it comes to the crash of Roswell, more is going on there than meets the eye. That's kind of obvious. And that there may be an extraterritorial national socialist state that has been developed unbeknownst to the Allies, unbeknownst to the Pentagon. And that the paperclip scientists may or may not be aware of it. Something else is going on here. There's something big happening here. Because even if the documents were faked, someone would have to put fake documents there at the time and make them look official and come up with this explanation that is engineerable in 1946. You see, even if it's fake, we gotta ask the obvious, don't we? Who benefits from this? Why is someone putting that in there? what is going on here. And by the way, even if you were going to push, the conspiracy rabbits are asking me about all the different media with aliens and stuff like that. Well, they have beat Roswell like a drum. Little green men, little green men, little green men, but there's no documents that back that up. Oh, they'll show you pictures of little green men. And by the way, also to his credit, he actually tracked down one of these models. You know the little model airplanes you have? Well, models have been around a long, long time, a lot longer than yours truly. And I don't know a lot about models, but he actually ended up buying an original tester model kit for the Roswell crash. An actual tester model kit. It doesn't look like a flying saucer. It looks like a Delta Wing aircraft. And that's apparently what it was. It was a Delta Wing aircraft, that actually had, some prototype engine in it. An engine that does not rely on gasoline, that's a neutronic engine. Something they had come across. And this is where he starts off, and this is where he starts digging into this stuff. And I was fascinating reading about it. It is fascinating reading about it because his thinking process is legitimate white rabbit. He's not racially minded, but he's solid in the head. And he's stating the obvious. He's pointing out the obvious, and he's using his skill set to pull it out. And that's when I started reading his work. And what he's done is discredited the little green men thing. That's what he's done, because someone has been relying on that little green man stuff a whole lot. I don't know, when you look at anything being kicked out of the media, who benefits from this? I don't know. I was asked directly about little green men and stargates and stuff like that. I don't know. I don't know anything about, I don't have any sourced information. Obviously, I've never seen a little green man, and I don't know anything about stargates, but I will grant you that when it comes to sci-fi and stargates and little green men, that stuff has been pushed down my throat during my lifetime. I don't doubt you there. So when it comes to media and aliens, I think we can all agree there's a lot there. Someone's pushing that angle. But what he's doing is discrediting one of the biggest events in the history of America, in the world, supposedly, and he's doing it in a very clever way. Very clever way, by pointing out the obvious. So that's when I really started keying on to him. The challenge you get into, by the way, when you open up Pandora's box, and he's not the only one that has done it. Joseph P. Farrell, Dr. Farrell, is not the only one that's done it. The difference is that he has the credentials to walk against the wall. You get into Nicholas Cook, is a pretty cool guy. He works for Jane's Information Group. He is an aerospace consultant. He's a go-to boy if you want to make a big announcement in aerospace, or so they say. And Nick Cook, for instance, he did in 2006, he did the big anti-gravity propulsion comes out of the closet. And Boeing did a general release through him. Boeing Aerospace did a big release through Nick Cook. So he's a go-to boy. And he wrote a famous book called Hunt for Zero Point. And he talks about the legend. And the legend is that the Nazis came across something. They came across something spectacular, but you see, Nick Cook doesn't have a skill set to go beyond that point for one particular reason. Now let's go back into the Bell, the Glock, because I've talked about this before. I talked about how outrageous it is. When you come into what they were doing, to play it fairly, you have to do one thing. You have to say, it doesn't matter what I believe. It doesn't matter what you believe. Tell me what the National Socialists believe. What did the Nazis believe? And when you walk into the NERB, the secret SS research bureau, when you walk into this stuff, this stuff that gets such big play in popular culture, you run up against a brick wall. Because what they are doing, what it says in their founding documents is, A, we are looking for Aryan origins. B, we are combing all historical myths, facts, so on and so forth. And we're looking for the potential technological implications thereof. And that's exactly from their founding documents. Now, in Joseph P. Farrell's credit, he reads German, so he's not disqualified there. He can walk in and say, fine, what are these guys looking at? How did they get so technologically advanced to start dealing with thermonuclear processes and neutronic engines? How did they get so advanced to give an explanation like that? What are they looking at? And then you walk into the anaerob, and you get into that, and then it sounds wacky. It sounds wacky because they're going back in time. They're looking at ancient texts. And so then you run it square into the Glock, the bell. Why do you run into that? You run into that because it's the only thing in all of, you know, I'm not a huge World War II historian buff, that type of thing, but the biggest challenge with the bell or the Glock is it's war decisive. It's the only thing in Nazi Germany that's war decisive. Why is it war decisive? You mean out of all these goodies, they're actually developing, according to Roswell documents, someone German knows about thermonuclear processes and neutronic engines, but yet this Bell thing is war decisive? What's going on here? But he has the ability to walk past that door. Because when you go into the ancient texts, what they were looking at, Nick Cook talks about this. He talks about the outrageous, in fact, I can read directly from his book, and I will in a minute. He talks about the outrageous defense formations that make no sense at all in military history. He talks about this in Hunt for Zero Point and whatnot. You know, the Germans are doing these wild formations around Prague and around Poland, and they're dispatching troops in all kinds of directions that looks absolutely nutty. Until you look at this one thing that was in development in these areas. This one thing called the Glock that was war decisive. The only thing there war decisive. So what is this thing? But you run into a brick wall because they didn't invent it. No. No. When Nick Cook goes into this stuff, he's like, they got it out of ancient text. But of course, he can't read it. He doesn't have a doctorate in patristics. He doesn't understand any of that stuff. I mean, he doesn't understand the difference between Akkadian and Canaanite Phoenician and how that relates to the Hebrew languages and all that kind of stuff. Well, Dr. Farrell is not barred by that. When someone says, well, you're going to have to read German to look at that, and he says, fine, I read German. You're going to have to look at German translations of Sanskrit documents or a Enuma Elish. He's like, fine, I can do that. I can also tell you the difference between their translations and certain translations coming out of Anglosphere, maybe. In other words, the Germans may have translated stuff differently than those in Anglosphere or English speakers. Fascinating stuff this man knows about different caveats in the Bible, and I'll go into that because he's a fascinating character, and you know, he's a Christian. So, he's not writing from someone with an axe to grind. He's interested in the truth, but he's not inhibited. For instance, he knows all the different puns, all the different problems you're going to get into in translation, and exactly where to go to for a better translation. If you say that National Socialists got this out of Sanskrit text, and we've already talked about descent, the Germans believed that it was Sumer to ancient India into Germany, and the parties in let's say Anglosphere are always paying attention to Egypt, and they go Egypt, ancient Greece, and then you come out of ancient Greece into Rome, and then you come into the British Isles. That's the two lines. Not that they don't cross over some, but that's what the Germans were looking at. They were looking at India and Sumer. Not that they weren't paying attention to Egypt. We all know they were now. But what I'm saying is he's not handicapped like Nick Cook, who can talk about the aerospace. But when you say someone's pulling something out of ancient texts, everyone assumes they were lying. They were BSing. Well, you don't know that. They're white rabbits. You know, we're the rabbits that'll build a plane and then jump out of it. You can't predict behavior like that. So he just says, okay, fine. You know, I'm kind of skeptical about that, but show me what you're talking about. Point me in a direction and I can find it. And sure enough, it's there. And you see, that's one of the challenges. White rabbits sat around here and they didn't go forward. They went backwards. They believe that there was this paleo-ancient civilization. They believe that white rabbits descend from these Aryan gods. It doesn't matter what I believe or you believe. It matters what they believe. And if he played it fair. He went into the stuff. He talks about his relation to the Elohim of Babylon that end up in the Bible. He talks about all this stuff. He's making connections because he has the credentials to be able to do that. Whereas I would be hopeless reading Akkadian or knowing where to turn to for an actual Akkadian translation, or how the Germans might have interpreted something vastly different than those running other parts of Western civilization. You get into fascinating conversations, but he doesn't hit that brick wall. He goes through it, over it, under it, and starts digging up stuff, and he points it out. He says, you know, it's right there, and I'm going to go more into this because it's fascinating stuff, and it's a big deal for white rabbits. why was this labeled war decisive? Well, the first reason would be the obvious. If you can weaponize this type of physics, if you can bring it out, it's a doomsday weapon. We've all heard about the Nazis and their fascination with doomsday weapons. And I'm going to take a break, and I'm going to be back with you here in a few seconds, and we're going to talk about this more, because I'm sure you're a little more fascinated. When it comes down to the last days of World War II, there's some very strange stuff, to say the least. When you read Joseph P. Farrell's books, one of the challenges is, if you're a skeptical white rabbit like yours truly, you read his Nazi books first in order, and don't think you know what they're about, because that's what yours truly did. This man has sources. He has legitimate sources. He has, like, government documents. He has everything you could ever want to prove his case that there was an existence of National Socialists post-National Socialist Germany, not within Germany necessarily, but not excluding it. He proves his case. So before you go jump into conclusions thinking he's talking about Hanabus and all this silly UFO stuff, he is not. He is not. It's much more intriguing than that. So if you're a skeptical white rabbit, you want to read his National Socialist books first, read them in order, and look at his sources. This guy's not coming up with pie in the sky. He's an actual researcher. He knows what he's doing, and he knows how to do it. And his sources in the Nazi books are very good. They're as good as you're going to see. However, if you are a fantasy rabbit, I don't guess it would matter. But you have to understand that all his books are most likely mistitled because of the place that published it. The place that published it was the only place, Adventures Unlimited Press is probably the only place crazy enough to publish this guy. When you start getting into what I call the Crazy Pyramid books, they're called the Giza Death Star in the Cosmic War series, where he goes into ancient texts. He's threading it with what the Nazis were looking at. He's doing it in a very indirect way. It's easy to read for me. I had to read his Nazi books. Then I went through and read his Crazy Pyramid books. Then I went back through and skimmed them all together. And then I emailed him with a direct, from my personal email, I emailed very direct questions to make sure I understood what this guy was saying. And once I confirmed it, then it becomes very clear. But he's not writing it, in other words, he's writing it it's not cryptic at all once you read everything through. But for some people it can be. I had to email him direct questions on, alright, Dr. Farrell, you're saying this, this, and this from these texts that they got this. I mean, that's obviously what you're alluding to. Yeah, look to page this and look to that, read this. You know, that's what he's doing. He has legitimate sources for things. He's not pie in the sky, but he goes, it's a tremendous amount of material, and he's crossing a lot of different lanes because you're getting into interpretations of the Old Testaments. And I'm going to go back into this. You're getting into stuff that is mostly taboo that I had never seen anyone write about. I've heard people talk about, but I hadn't seen anyone write about it and what they were actually looking at, the National Socialists. But in the last days of the war, you have all this strange stuff. And what he calls it in one of his books, when he starts talking, in one of his Crazy Pyramid books, it's called The Giza Death Star Deployed, which I don't think he titled any of these things, because it's not about that at all. But anyways, he calls it the Inventory of High Strangeness. And he talks about stuff that Nick Cook and other historians have talked about, looking at the last days of World War II. And I'll read it to you. Hitler, during a conference with his generals in the bunker in 1945, made the wild pronouncement. When questioned by one of them as to why the strongest and best formations left to the Wehrmacht were deployed, not in defense of Berlin, but of Prague, that Prague was the key to winning the war. Allied military intelligence also confirmed that the strongest SS Panzer formations were deployed in the vicinity of Prague, an order of battle that on the plain face of things made no military sense to them other than as the Allies' own estimates of the situation concluded that Berlin had ceased to be an important economic and military target. Which is kind of interesting. And I'm going to get back to this Prague and what was going on the Eastern Front. But then you have another thing. General Patton's U.S. Third Army literally raced through Bavaria into Bohemia, making a beeline for the famous Skoda Armaments works at Pilsen, all but blown off the map by Allied bombing raids. you had all this crazy talk coming from Hitler and everyone around him. You have all these, you have Patton and certain groups within Anglosphere going after what most would think, well, they want first shot at all the Nazi secret weapons before the Russians get in there. Well, that's kind of what you see is what you get, but I now believe there's another reason. It's much more provocative. One of the other reasons, at least. I don't think Patton knew about it, but I think elements in Anglosphere did. And I don't think elements were necessarily opposed to it. But anyways, you have all this crazy redeployment. And what was in these areas? Well, what was in these areas is everything attached to this bell, the Glock. Why is it war decisive? Well, it's war decisive if you can get a doomsday weapon. Because once you start engineering, let's go back over to what I'm talking about here. Let me give you an example. I've said before that the swastika is a solar symbol. We all know that. It's a solar symbol. But there's a scientific implication to it too, or the Nazis believed. You see, what they are doing with the bell is a rotating plasma. They're creating a device to test a particular technology that mimics the sun. If you look up from your iPhone and you're going to see that big ball of light up there in the sky, that's the sun. We all know that. I hope at least you know that. That sun is producing serious energy, to say the least. The sun is nothing but rotating plasma. That's all it is. What they are doing is bringing out a testing technology that mimics rotating plasma. Now they're bringing out a gateway technology. It's not a UFO. You can't ride around the thing. In fact, when it first went off, a number of scientists who had been exposed to the device during these experiments suffered terrible side effects. Five were said to have died from the results. When this thing first went off, it was killing people. And so it's just a testing technology, and there's a lot of mystery about it because of the names. You have all these defensive formations around this stuff. It's war decisive. You have certain elements within the Allied going right to these areas. And you have all kinds of mysteries. And Nick Cook came across this in his hunt for Zero Point, and he's, of course, he's a heavyweight in the aerospace industry. And he talks about on the Czech frontier, they had begun in 1944 and carried on in the April of that following year under the nose of an advancing Russian army. And they got all these new defensive formations and whatnot around them. The experiments required, and I'm quoting here from, Joseph P. Dr. Farrell quoting Nick Cook in the Giza Death Star Deployed, which is kind of a crazy title. The experiments require large doses of electricity fed via thick cabling into a chamber hundreds of meters below the ground. In this chamber, a bell-shaped device comprising two counter-rotating cylinders filled with mercury-like substance or something like it, had emitted a strange pale blue light. And he goes on to talk about this stuff. And then what Joseph P. Farrell had to do is when you start talking about this thing, you're going to run into a brick wall. Because what you will find out is that they didn't invent this gateway technology. They resurrected it out of ancient text. Which is kind of wild. Then the only question becomes, are they BSing? Is this true? And what Dr. Farrell has a skill set, he has a skill set of reading this stuff because he has a doctorate in patristics from Oxford, which means he knows all about ancient texts, especially the ones they would be looking at. Or, you know, what they got a hold of, how to translate the stuff. You know, he there's a minefield of problems for the average person that he wouldn't be inhibited by. And so he just blows through this stuff. And sure enough, there it is. It doesn't matter whether it's in Sumer. He pretty much proves to me that these Mercury Vortex engines, which is really what this thing landed with, in short, at Roswell, they got it out of these ancient texts, which of course opens a whole Pandora's box. Because they didn't view one of the challenges with saying it's war decisive is shortly after the war, certain parties certainly had this stuff engineerable somewhat. If they wanted a doomsday device, why didn't they set it off? other people have asked this question too. All right, if they have this technology, if this technology is sophisticated enough to be engineerable in 1946, if you're saying that they're flying around in this stuff, evading U.S. airspace or basically coming into U.S. airspace with impunity even after the war from somewhere, somewhere out there has this stuff. Even if it's American black projects, this stuff, there are Nazis with their hands on this stuff, National Socialists, it has been engineered. Why did they set it off? And you're talking about something that would be mimicking the power of the sun, and the sun has a lot of power. That's why the kind of fascination with the swastika. They're dealing with what this means scientifically. They're resurrecting an energy source, it could go in multiple different directions, but one of the directions would be weapons. And if it was, engineered, which, I mean, he pretty much proves it was, why didn't they let it off? What else are we missing here? If it's war decisive, they have all these defensive formations around it, it's a doomsday weapon, and Nazis had it not only during the war, but after the war, it's showing up at Roswell in one way, shape, manner, or form. Why didn't they set off a doomsday weapon? I mean, you could annihilate this planet with this thing. If you could weaponize it, you could build a weapon with it. And let's face it, they had all kinds of wild stuff going on. Why was this the only thing labeled war decisive? And that's where it becomes fascinating. Because when you get into these ancient texts, the problem, the brick wall that most people come up against, Dr. Farrell doesn't have that problem. And what he's telling you is that there's something else implied in these texts as well. Something else that's quite fascinating. I had to email him back and forth to make sure I understood what he was saying. And I won't go into that now. No, I'm going to save that. That is, you know, I already hit you with the fact that they resurrected this thing, and that's what the guy's proven. He's proven that's what everyone's looking at. He's not the first one to say it. He's just the first one to have proved it. Because he has that particular skill set. Not that it hasn't been done behind the scenes, I don't know. But there's something else implied in these texts that would make it war decisive. Not in 1946 or 47, but you had to make sure the thing went off. And they were setting this thing off. And I could just imagine white rabbits walking in to Mein Fuhrer and saying, well, you know what? We found this ancient thing in these ancient texts, and you say we descend from these white rabbit gods and whatnot, and the biblical Elohim, and you were looking for Aryan origins. Well, we have an interesting solution to our big dilemma, as well as our weapons needs and everything else. There's blueprints for something in this. And all we need is our own power plant and all this money to resurrect this thing. Oh, come on now. It's only logical white rabbit behavior. It's only logical white rabbit behavior. Sure. It's about as logical as flying a plane and jumping out of it. It's nuts. It's so nuts that most people hear it and they don't believe it, but that's really what he's proving in these translations and whatnot that he's pulled out. You almost need a how-to guide for someone like me to read his books, but I had to go through them a couple times and ask him direct questions, and sure enough, I'll save that for a rainy day, and I'll come back to this in case it gets ugly here in the next 90 days. I'll give you what this thing does, but it is war decisive, and he goes into this in the Alchemical Reich, how the Germans viewed war. You see, one of the challenges is you have these nutballs out there that think the Germans threw a war or something like that. Well, they didn't. They were going all out to win the war. But they viewed war on much more terms than what you see is what you get. They wanted this thing going off, and they had its own electric. It wouldn't need its own power plant. You just need to charge the thing up. But they gave it its own power plant because they were hitting it with direct volts of electricity. They were basically hitting it with lightning bolts. They had the thing dancing around. They were pulsing it. They were pulsing it in certain sequences and whatnot. And this is a fascinating thing because obviously if they got it from the text, and I believe they got it from the text, I got to believe that it was war decisive for the reasons they thought it was war decisive too. And you also have to believe that they were guarding it for a particular reason. If you say it's a doomsday weapon, well, then I got to say, why didn't they set it off? Because there's Nazis, according to this guy, and he's got the sources in Nazi International and SS and the Brotherhood of the Bell. They are clearly around. They are clearly have their hands on this stuff and in everything. Why didn't they set it off? If they wanted to end the world, they could. What are they setting up? And what does this have to do with right now? That's where it becomes fascinating. And I'll leave this for another rainy day, but his books are mind-bending stuff for white rabbits, simply because he's answering all the questions. He's dotting the I's and crossing the T's. But you do need, I needed a Joseph P. Farrell books for dummies. But if you are a skeptic, I'd read his Nazi book in order, and I would do it. If you are a fantasy white rabbit, you can start with any of them, or start with the Crazy Pyramid books and read them in order. I call them Crazy Pyramid books simply because they're mistitled. He's got stuff threaded all through there, everything you ever wanted to know. But he is one-stop shopping for someone like me, because I cannot sit here and talk about these stuff with you conspiracy rabbits, especially the white rabbits that love that stuff, that those sites get all kinds of hits, without someone that's sourced. He's not only sourced, he's sourced with sources that, you know, even when he's talking about certain translations of, let's say, Babylonian texts from Akkadian by Zachariah Sitchin, I don't particularly care for him. I don't care for his translations. I think they're biased, but I don't know how to pick and choose. He knows how to pick and choose what translations would be good from him and what would be bad. He knows very clever stuff, but he's spent his whole entire life looking at this stuff, and that's been all the rage for his generation, is looking at the Sumerian texts and how they relate to the formation of the Bible and all the little missing pieces and stuff. Fascinating stuff. Fascinating stuff when it comes to the Old Testament. And I may hit on that a few more, because there's been some direct questions on it, on what I think about certain things, because I mentioned the biblical Nephilim and the Elohim and whatnot. One of the challenges when you get into the Old Testament, you have a variety of different episodes in the Sumerian text crammed together. They're crammed together, one over top of each other, where it becomes very difficult. And I'll come back to this point. This is something I learned a long time ago about this stuff. But he points this out, and he's trying to help the Christians in the audience, or even the pagans who think this stuff is meaningless, help them through this stuff. But that's what's fascinating about the bell. It's war decisive. The only thing in National Socialist is war decisive. Most people think it's war decisive because it's a doomsday weapon. But why didn't they set it off? What else? Why else would it be war decisive? Is there something we're missing? Yeah, there was. There was. And I'm sure according to him, we are already seeing it, but we don't see anything anyways. But it's fascinating stuff, and I'm going to come back to this again before I make the final point on why this is war decisive. But it's in his books. It's under the Alchemical Reich on how they view it. It's fascinating. It's a fascinating topic. And I'll be back with you, and we're going to go on, and I'm going to talk about some other stuff, because I've been asked direct questions. I'll answer them directly about how I view his stuff. But the big deal with the bell is the fact that it's war decisive. It's the only thing in National Socialist Germany, only thing in Germany that's war decisive. Huge defensive formations around it. Everyone's going after this thing. Someone knows what it does. In other words, Horace the Avenger, yours truly, believes someone in the Allied side, not General Patton, but someone, knew exactly what they were doing with this stuff, knew exactly where they got it, and were scared to death. And that has everything to do with what's going on right now. And that's what he's telling you as well. But he's one-stop shopping when it comes to conspiracy theories, because he hears all the good stuff and he talks about it. I hear all kinds of stuff that you would deem good and crazy. I'm just not crazy enough to talk about it. He's crazy enough to talk about it. And when it comes to researching ancient texts, he's got the credentials to get my attention. And he's a clear-thinking white rabbit. So even when he's speculating, he says, I'm speculating, or this is a hypothesis. He develops a hypothesis, and he goes about proving it. He proves it with sources and overwhelms you with information. Apparently, when it comes to National Socialist survival post-World War II, he's only revealed anywhere from 10 to 15% of his information. I've heard not more than 20%. He can overwhelm you with this stuff. I mean, he can just overwhelm you. Listen to him talk. When it comes to his knowledge, and you know, this stuff, basically, when he went back into it, I'm guessing it kind of connected a few dots for him, too. But he's not a racial thinker. He doesn't necessarily care for him, but he does care for the truth. And that's what's important to white rabbits, just the facts. But he did play it fair. He did not say they're a bunch of crazy Nazi murderers, and no, he says, what is true here? You know, let's look at what they're looking at. Fine, I read German. Fine, I know all the different pitfalls. I know all the different pitfalls in the language of Cana or Canaanite Phoenician. What you think of as the ancient Hebrew language is simply the language of Cana, and there's several different challenges when you walk into that. When you walk into Akkadian and the different translations out of Sumer, that's the language in Sumer is Akkadian, and there's a link between all of them. It becomes a challenge. But he's someone that is, you know, he's dealt with this stuff from day one, and he could teach it at a seminary level. So you're kind of dealing with something that's pretty rare to have something like him writing. What's ironic is that he's stuck at Adventures Unlimited Press and no one knows about him. You have the conspiracy white rabbits who don't think in racial terms reading this stuff. You have the, I was asked, why aren't all the Stormfronters reading this guy? Well, they don't know about him. I'm the only one that's ever put out an MP3 talking about the guy. He's my official, because if I gotta talk about these issues, I gotta have someone sourced and someone that's gonna at least be official. This guy's official. This guy's tantalizing. He's what everyone's reading. His latest book is, Roswell and the Reich, and he proves that it was the Germans behind Roswell. He opens up all the different fake documents. There are fake documents in Roswell. Yeah, there are some fake documents that come out afterwards. But even that, who benefits from this? Why is this being produced? He connects all the dots. He talks about everything. He talks about what this had to do with maybe certain blackmail scenarios that developed out of there. He talks about all kinds of stuff. He lets it all hang out in Roswell, his latest book, and it is, to my knowledge, sold out. The thing just went on sale and it sold out. He's also going in Banksters from Here to Babylon. He's talking about that stuff. He's naming names. He doesn't hesitate. I was asked a direct question on why, because certain parties, I'm damned if I do and I'm damned if I don't in this. There are certain parties that didn't understand why I'm talking about him. I think he's one of the most significant characters in European history because he's putting together pieces for you in a way that the average white rabbit would never have someone do in a $13 book. And also he has legitimate sources, so he's not just dreaming stuff up. But I was asked why, you know, I get some people don't understand why I think he's important. Others, on the other hand, I get these people saying that I shouldn't talk about him at all, that the Stormfronters and whatnot don't deserve to know about him. Believe it or not, there are white rabbits, even racialists, that believe that. Because some of the stuff, the conspiracy white rabbits are saying, how is this guy allowed to write this stuff? Well, a lot of times in this society, you have legitimate information coming out illegitimate sources. I remember one of the Chinese spy scandals, and there's been several Chinese spy scandals, the last one in California or whatnot. Well, you know, the average spy might look in the LA Times, and they might see an ad for, looking for housing and looking to house white rabbits. In other words, you go under help wanted or housing wanted, and you look at an ad, and the ad says, housing wanted, a yuppie couple who has pet rabbits. Then all of a sudden you call that number and you hit a special code and you get your messages off of it. And the messages aren't messages, but they're instructions. Now here you have something like the LA Times. It's not a legitimate source of information. No, sorry, you're not. But it becomes a legitimate source of information for somebody that knows how to operate in there, that knows how to hit the codes. Well, when you start dealing with it, and that, there was a latest spy scandal in California, but that is spy-type stuff. But this whole society works like that. So you have Adventures Unlimited Press, which I've never bought a book from there, other than Joseph P. Farrell stuff, Dr. Farrell stuff. Not to say that they're not good. It's my bias. But most of the stuff's garbage, I think. I mean, I'm sorry. That's what I think. Because they don't reveal sources. If you're going to pontificate, that's wonderful. Give me your sources. Tell me, you know, where are you getting this conclusion? Well, how are you deriving this conclusion? But that is how stuff is coming out. So you have one side of the equation that says, well, you shouldn't be talking about that because, they don't deserve to know about it. Well, I never take that view. Then you have another side of the equation, the conspiracy rabbit saying, how is this guy writing this stuff? That he's got to be getting watched. Yeah, he's watched night and day, but he's not watched for the reasons you think he's watched. Because he's not watched necessarily for Nazi stuff. His stuff didn't come out till 2003, which is interesting in itself. why is that information being produced? But he's not a national socialist. I can tell you that right now. But he is a truth seeker. So he starts kicking this stuff out in 2003. This is not, he would be being washed because what he's saying about Roswell, that would tick off some parties who planned on using that, who now don't have near as much power to use it the way they want it to. He would also be watched because of what he's saying about certain translations having to do with not with the New Testament, but with the Old Testament. What he's telling you, not that it's an eye-opener. He's opening your eyes to things, and he knows how to read the text. Not that it's not true. What he's telling you is it's true. It's just not true in the way you think it's true. You don't know the correct way to read the stuff. And I'm going to go into a couple of those things because I was asked direct questions. I got half the audience members who think I'm a pagan, and half the audience members who don't like it because they think I'm a Christian or something. Well, I'm doing my job because I should keep you guessing on that. Religion has been very contentious for most white rabbits. It's hurt a lot of good, nice white rabbits without the need. But that's why he's being watched. He's being watched because of his knowledge of religion. Not that he's not a Christian. Not that he's out to debunk something. He's opening up your eyes to something in the Old Testament. And I'll go into that a little bit. But that's why he's watched. I think as long as you can write something and give your supporters, give your sources and support your opinion, so be it. But I'll let you have everything good out there. But he is good. He's not pie in the sky. He's not writing about Hannibus. But you see the challenge when it comes to Roswell, when it comes to flying saucers, and even the Hannibus, all the massive neo-Nazi stuff coming out of World War II that just can't die. You see, he asks the question, who benefits from this? Where's this stuff coming from? There's a huge amount of propaganda coming from that angle, too. He talks about this, no holds barred. But he is not liked because of how honest he is on some certain translations. In other words, he's opening up certain things for dialogue in the Old Testament that are verboten to some parties, especially the Jew rabbits. He knows how to tell you a few things in a very indiscreet way, and I'll go into that briefly, and we'll end this particular one. And I'm going to continue these question and answers because I've got more of them, but I'll talk about this for a few minutes here. I'll be back with you in a minute, and I'll talk a little bit about why this is, of course, the conspiracy white rabbits, that why is he allowed to talk about this? Because he's obviously being watched. Certain parties have talked about, Dick Hoagland has said blatantly that Joseph P. Farrell watched like a hawk. Well, it's because of religion. It's not because of, it's a small part to do with Roswell. And what his latest book says. And another part is a couple different things he's alluding to in the different translations of the Old Testament, the difference between Eastern and Western Christianity, some different things he's alluded to that are extremely, if he would have wrote it 10 years earlier, he would probably be dead. There's no way they will let that slide. But I'll be back and I'll talk with you a little bit more about that. But he's a fascinating character. You just got to watch how you read his books, and you got to be kind of a student in reading them. I had to read them, then read them again in order, and then ask him direct questions to find out the truth of what he's alluding to. But it's in there. He puts it right in front of your face. But that is why the bell is, there is another reason why the Glock, this bell-shaped thing you see dancing on the Discovery Channel, is war decisive. And that reason will be forthcoming. I'm just not going to tell you on this particular show. I'll wait till a dark hour to tell you that or something. But I'll talk about, because the conspiracy white rabbits have asked some legitimate questions, I prefer you not know my faith or whatnot simply because it is, I don't think it's not part of my particular job. My job is to put you on a consistent message, but to at the same time entertain you. So I got to give you something. I'm not a religious scholar. Joseph P. Farrell is. Dr. Farrell is a religious scholar. He's forgotten more about it than you or I will know, and he's alluding some very important things. Not necessarily in the New Testament, but I'll give you my particular view on what he's saying and how this fits in with what has been coming out during his lifetime, especially post World War II. Interesting enough. And I'll be back with you, and we'll do that. Now I'll end this particular MP3, and there'll be another question and answer coming out as well. Since the translations of the Sumerian text, it has become pretty much the thing to do for someone like a Dr. Farrell, or even many of the New Agers that are listening here, the conspiracy white rabbits, the New Age white rabbits, all they're reading about are the Sumerian texts, the actual translations and the different translations. Zachariah Sitchin, you know, he wrote Inki Speaks. And those are translations, his style translation of the Sumerian text. Some of it predate the Bible, but most of the characters are in the Bible, believe it or not. But that becomes controversial, to say the least, these different translations. And so what someone like Dr. Farrell has spent, you know, as a doctor in patristics, early church history, is reading these different translations coming out and being able to take out a piece of, let's say, the King James Bible and tell you exactly what it means in Akkadian or the language of Cana, the different translations of it, and exactly where they're going with it. So I mentioned the word Nephilim. I mentioned the big prince Marduk of the Sumerian pantheon. I mentioned, but in every time you mention these things, you got to put them in context. And I am not a theologian. That's not the emphasis of the show. But I will talk about it because I have these conspiracy, and New Agers have asked me specifically what I mean by that. What I will say is I'll do a little piece on giants. Dr. Farrell has covered every single piece of territory you could want to cover. From his own angle and from a more legitimate angle than most, simply because he has the credentials. So when you see, when you look at Genesis and it says giants are on the earth and the sons of God came into the daughters of men, well, he can pull that out and tell you exactly what they're talking about, which are the Ben Elohim, and Ben Elohim in the language of Cana means sons of God, for the most part. He could tell you exactly who they were, exactly which ones they were, who caused the problems in the Sumerian pantheon, and all kinds of other interesting things. That becomes kind of controversial, obviously. One of the challenges when you do that is that when you get into the Eastern Orthodox and the Catholic faiths and several other churches, they have a tradition of being able to do that. But there is a branch of Protestantism in America that most of my foreign listeners might not be aware of, or I'm sure actually you are aware of. They're Zionist. And they basically, there's elements of Protestantism in America, especially America, that have thrown out the New Testament and went back to the Old Testament. And they don't do any, they refuse to read any of that stuff. It becomes very, very dangerous, not only for them, but very difficult for someone there trying to help them, like a Dr. Farrell. If you're a seminary student, even at a Baptist Bible college, you're going to be aware of the Enuma Elish. Enuma Elish is a Babylonian creation epic. What they're saying is that my sources say it is not a creation epic. It is a war epic. Well, that's a big difference. And this has become in vogue, or the thing to do. Most of the white racialist rabbits are totally ignorant of it. By and large, they have no idea what has come out on this stuff, or even how fascinating it is. What does this have to do with National Socialism? Well, it has everything to do with it. You know, the New Ager, you know, I have some listeners that are pretty bright, in so much as they've read Dr. Farrell's books and they know all about the Sumerian pantheon and how it relates to National Socialism or what they were looking for. What they were looking for was white rabbit origins. And most of these listeners are not racially aware, but they realize, that there's something, an interplay going on. And most of the racial, if you go to stormfront.org, you will see those arguing that the Nazis were pagan and the Nazis were Christian. Where we see differentiations between different types of Christianity and different, let's say, pagan myths and legends, what they were doing is reconciling. They may not see the differentiation you see or I see. They would call it a level of pollution from one to the other. And I can give all the Christian listeners a classic example of what has been going on. When you get into Genesis 26, and God said, "Let us make man in our image after our likeness," that's a big sentence. That's a big statement. That's very controversial. What the National Socialists were looking for were absolute white rabbit origins. You see, when it says, "And God says, let us make man in our image and our likeness," what they would do is they would say, what does this mean in Akkadian or Canaanite Phoenician? Because what you think of is the Hebrew language, if you look at the opening of your companion King James Bible, you'll find out that there is no Hebrew language. It'll tell you it's the language of Cana. And there's several different variations that have came out of it that you know of as ancient Hebrew. And modern Hebrew has no real relation to it, according to most. But you get into a slippery minefield of how to translate that, because we read in the English language, but our eyes glance over it. We don't understand that it's saying, let us make man. You see, make and create is not the same thing. You know, if Harry Potter waves his magic wand and he creates a cake, well, that's magic. If Harry Potter takes Betty Crocker and puts the ingredients together and makes a cake, well, that's not the same thing. And so they're saying, what was made in the image and likeness of God? How do you define man? Who these guys are? And the correct translation is the Elohim said. And all right, who were the Elohim? What does this mean? And of course, in the Christian tradition, you would say the Trinity. In the Jewish tradition, you have a plurality of royalty. And it says the same thing in the Quran, the same translation. It's a plurality of royalty. The Elohim are speaking. Well, who in the Elohim is speaking? Do they have different titles? Yes, they do. And this becomes controversial. What Dr. Farrell is saying, many of the elements of Protestantism and throwing out the New Testament and throwing out all the processes of looking at things again and revisionism and things that go on in the Catholic Church, like throwing out this name or throwing out that name or redoing something trying to help bridge the gap. They've thrown a lot of that out. They couldn't have thrown out everything because they do have intelligent design. Most of you have heard of the term intelligent design. If you're not an American white rabbit, you do your homework, you're going to find out that the Protestant faith is big on intelligent design. Well, let us make man in our image and our likeness. That's not creating anything. That's where they're getting that from. Someone's putting that in there to try to help them. And I could go more into that and tell you exactly how someone has told me this is how it reads in the language of Cana. It doesn't read like we read it straight away. You know, we tend to think they're talking about man, mankind, or all of Homo sapiens. No, they're not talking about that at all. But what the National Socialists are doing is they're saying what was made in the image and likeness of God, who they are, and where they're at. And what they believe that there was an ancient paleo-ancient civilization, what you will think of as a level one or level three civilization. I'll use the famous Russian astronomer, and his name escapes me. He came out with that there were three types of civilizations in the universe. Level one, which would eventually be able to harness the whole resources of a planet, and probably one of the major stars, kind of like if we use this, we brought out this new technology, we would be in a late stage level one. We would be able to have free energy and everything like that. But we're nowhere close to the late stages right now of a level one. A level two civilization would be able to utilize the resources successfully of a whole entire solar system. A level three civilization would be able to harness the whole entire resources of a galaxy or several galaxies. What they believed, and it doesn't matter what I believe or you believe, but what they believed, what the National Socialists believe, and several different parties in Europe, is that there were a level three or a high level two civilization that left monuments on Earth of their civilization, of a very high civilization, that a war broke it up, or they left for a period of time out of this backwater solar system. They left monuments at various different places, and we've heard of stuff on Mars, on the moon Phobos. Buzz Aldrin had talked about a monolith on one of the Martian moons, Phobos. All this different type of stuff, and I don't really know where it's going necessarily. I can only give you the facts. This isn't what it doesn't matter what we believe. It matters what they believe. One of the things that Alex Jones does quite well is he will tell you that it really doesn't matter what we believe. You need to know what the elites believe. And if they believe it, you might want to be aware of it. Well, that's what the National Socialists believe. So when Dr. Farrell got into the National Socialists, you end up in a minefield that he can navigate, because he can go back in time and look at what they're looking for and look at how they're reconciling myth and legend and how they're pulling things out. Like I said before, it's all fun and games until someone erects a piece of technology from a level, a paleo-ancient civilization that was never supposed to exist. It's all fun and games until someone does that. once someone does that, it opens up a Pandora's box for someone like me. But he's the one, the only one that I've ever seen write about this stuff. Fairly and squarely, looking for the truth, not some variation of the truth. And so when you come into Nephilim or particular verses of the Bible, he's a go-to person where you can read his books and you can ask intelligent questions of who are these sons of God? What are they talking about? Is there any corresponding Sumerian text? Is there any corresponding text that we could open this up to so we can understand it? Because if you have sons of God, Nephilim, then all of a sudden giants on the earth and all this stuff going on, what's going on here? It's all shoved together. You have, you know, fallen angels. What do they mean by that? You know, what do they mean by fallen angels? You know, they're not talking about big spooks in the sky, by the way. What are they talking about when they're talking about, you know, this particular reference to angels, which simply can mean that which came from above. And it has, you know, depending on how it's used or where it's used. Elohim is a controversial word because in you know, there's one side of the equation. My New Age listeners would say, or the conspiracy white rabbits, well, Horus, it means gods. It's plural because El is Canaanite Phoenician for God. You know, all the Christians have heard El Shaddai, and that's a particular son of God, or something along those lines. But we've all heard these words. What do they mean? Where are they coming from? But Elohim can mean God, and it can mean gods. It can be plural, depending on its grammatical usage. But what they have done is someone like him walks in and breaks down a particular part and tells you this is what it means, and this is what it means for Christianity. And what he is saying, some of my Christian listeners have read his stuff, and they're kind of blown away by this stuff, that he's opening up a whole new dialogue and a whole new light on what this stuff is where these verses come from, what they're talking about. It's not as stale as it was in catechism for me. But it becomes very, very fascinating and also extremely provocative, and not something that you're going to make a lot of money doing. It is extremely dangerous for him to do it for obvious reasons. So when you get into Nephilim or giants, one of the problems with giants is you know, there's been all this, as the internet has come online, I guess, all these different researchers have come out with different quotes from about giants being on the earth and all this stuff dug up, even in America, in early American history. Apparently, they were digging up giants left and right. You know, I don't mind it if they got legitimate sources. I have no doubt there's a lot of this planet we don't understand. I'm fully convinced of that. But in regards to the famous researcher Stephen Quayle, that's Steve, and then Quayle, you know, he's a classical conspiracy white rabbit. He writes about all kinds of crazy stuff and then tries to curve fit it in the Bible. You got to kind of watch that because he's not a scholar on some of those ancient languages and what they're meaning by Nephilim. You know, he talks about one of the great German kings after the in Teutoburg Forest, the Romans got annihilated. They got annihilated by Germans. And the Germans, at the time, Europeans, elements of Europe, did not look as small as we do now. White rabbits were a lot bigger. And one of these kings was paraded, the Roman historian Floras, Floras. He was paraded in a Roman, victory parade. They had captured one of these German kings, Teutobach. And I don't know how to pronounce his name, but I could give you the name or the reference. But anyways, this Roman historian's talking about him. And this German king is taller than the trophies that are on top of spears. The historians say he's at least 9 feet tall. But these Germans, and as well as the Celts, were huge. Some of the different writers that talk about what was in Ireland at the time, they're huge. White rabbits were a lot bigger. But when you say that, you know, he's 9 feet tall, he's obviously descends from Nephilim or something like that, you can't exactly, go that direction simply because, you know, we don't know the benchmark for man. We don't know that a healthy human shouldn't be 9 or 10 feet tall. We don't know that. Sir Francis Drake, I believe it was, the Cocopah Indians. Dr. Farrell covers all this stuff. When they sailed into South America, the Cocopah Indians, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correct, were like 9 feet tall. But that doesn't mean they're Nephilim. That doesn't mean they descend from these wicked giants that are in the Bible. It has nothing to do with apples. We don't know how tall we should be if we're healthy. And that's one of the challenges with this. In the famous book, The Odyssey, we have Odysseus, and we have Polyphemus. Polyphemus is a famous Cyclops. He's a son of Poseidon. And I'll talk more about Poseidon in a minute here, but Polyphemus, of course, traps little Odysseus in the Greek epic, The Odyssey. And in his cave, he traps Odysseus and Odysseus' little white rabbit buddies. And Polyphemus has sheep and he has milk, but he starts eating Odysseus' buddies. He locks them in there and is eating them for breakfast and supper and whatnot. Well, this, of course, ticks off Odysseus, and Odysseus puts out his eye. He puts out his big Cyclops eye. It's a famous story in Western tradition. And he puts out Odysseus' eye, and then he escapes with what's left of his buddies. But we don't know how tall Odysseus would be. We don't know how tall a normal Greek would be at the time, and we don't know how tall Polyphemus was, because he was obviously a giant. In other words, just because the average German or the Kokopah Indian is 9 feet, that doesn't mean they're giants. A giant might be 50 feet or 100 feet. But they do dig up a lot of big bones, and I don't know the whole story. They did in America. There's all kinds of stuff supposedly in basements of museums of giant bones, but we don't know. We're kind of in the dark right now. I'm sure it'll all come out very soon, sooner rather than later when they start reconciling all this stuff. But I was asked about a direct question about Zachariah Sitchin. Zachariah Sitchin is used, Joseph P. Farrell uses different famous conspiracy writers, if you will, in a very unique way. For instance, he only uses Stephen Quayle when Stephen Quayle, the giant researcher, is using legitimate sources. Augustine is a legitimate source. Some of the early Christian fathers, when they talk about giants, are good sources. The Roman historian Floras is a good source, but when he starts going pie in the sky wild stuff, he doesn't use them. Zachariah Sitchin is a big Enki follower, Iyah, as he's known in Egypt. And I was asked direct questions about Enki, and for the Christians, I won't give you the names. I don't want to go into all that right this minute. Maybe I will another time. But what I will tell the listeners of mine that are big on Iyah or Enki, Ea as he's known in Sumerian texts, is that he is not the nice guy, Sumerian god, that Zachariah Sitchin makes him out to be, in my opinion. That's what Joseph P. Farrell's telling you. He's telling you that some of those texts are very questionable. Where he uses Zachariah Sitchin, he uses Zachariah Sitchin where he believes he's correct. But Zachariah Sitchin pushes Enki, makes Enki sound wonderful. If you read any, you can read all his stuff online. He'll make Iyah sound wonderful. But I would keep this in mind because most of my New Age or conspiracy white rabbit listeners don't know how to do this. None of the others are even aware of who I'm talking about. But you can cross mythologies. So you can take the Sumerian pantheon, and you can take Iyah, who's Lord God of Seas, and you can read about him in the Odyssey. Yeah, that's Poseidon. Your beloved Iyah is Poseidon, and I don't think he's that nice. Odysseus is defending himself, and he puts out Polyphemus' eye. Well, Poseidon doesn't like that, but Poseidon can't kill Odysseus because Zeus won't allow it. Zeus says, no. Zeus is the big Cohiba. And so he won't let him kill Odysseus, but he sure does torture him to death. I mean, Poseidon's the patron of the Phaeacians, and the Phaeacians help Odysseus get home. And for helping Odysseus, he kills him and sinks one of their ships. He doesn't sound that nice to me. So the god of seas, it really depends. You know, in other words, he's the father. Odysseus did not have to, he did not have to obey anything Poseidon said. He did not have to obey the god of seas for one simple reason. It's not his father. Poseidon's the father of the wicked giants. And Odysseus had to obey Zeus because Zeus was his father. You know, Zeus is the father of God and man. And so there's a conflict between Zeus and Poseidon, which, of course, was won long, long ago. Poseidon talks in the Odyssey about one time he revolted and he fell for 7 days and seven nights. He wasn't going to try it again. Zeus whipped his tail. But anyways, when you're reading about Iyah or Enki, you can read about Poseidon and then make up your mind whether this guy is nice. He might be nice to the wicked giants, You know, if those things are real and you have descendants of those running around, they might be nice, but the reason many of the readers have asked me about that, I use the name Marduk. Marduk is a sun. In the Christian tradition, he is very, very famous. I don't particularly care for him. I don't care for his brother even more, and his brother is even more famous. His brother is Nergal. And no, neither one of those guys are nice. Those are, I conclude that he would be like, Poseidon would be a red hippo, and those would be red hippo babies. Marduk probably a little bit nicer than his brother Nergal, who was a murderer. He was a nutball. He's the great cherub that covereth. And God found iniquity in him and whipped his tail. And Marduk got lost too. They lost two great wars in the Sumerian pantheon. They're losers, basically. That's why their father sits second seat. But they're not nice. Nergal especially is not nice. He's not nice at all. But you can cross all this stuff together, and you can easily figure out who Ea or Enki is. Most of you, my listeners, don't know how to do that. A whole percentage are probably now fascinated how this relates to the Bible and everything else. Well, the New Testament was only written in Greek. Even the ones that are in Aramaic, the writers in Aramaic, I'm talking about the original stuff, was only in Greek. So Greek is how you reconcile anything. You got to go back into what was going on at the time and try to play it fairly and not play it without biases. It's very difficult to do. But no, I would say on the Babylonian pantheon, the Sumerian pantheon, when you get into the big Cohiba, his name is El, Enil, or El, and his son Ninurta. Ninurta would most likely be Phoebus Apollo, and they would be the golden boys. That other side, you're dealing with baby red hippos, and they would be murderers. If they were alive walking around on this earth, well, that would be a rational explanation for me. You know, they would not like us any more than Poseidon liked Odysseus. But that's an overview of how you can cross mythologies, or how I look at it. But I'm not a big fan of Enki or Ea, and Zachariah Sitchin and his whole entire group are big promoters of his. But there's a few things missing there. There's a few things they're not telling you. But I prefer to read it all and make up my own mind. That's one of the great things about having someone like Dr. Farrell. He doesn't have an axe to grind. He's just trying to tell you the truth. But saying that Ea or Enki is this wonderful, he's a prankster, he's a punster, he's a Loki. That's who he is. His sons are demons, literally. He's problematic. He wouldn't like us, period. But that's another story for another day. And that's what he's there for. But this has become in vogue of breaking out these pieces and looking at their origins. And one of the challenges, what Dr. Farrell is saying, their frustration with elements of Protestantism, especially Zionism, because they threw out the New Testament and they went back to worshiping Jews, and doing all kinds of other crazy stuff. There is no process for revision. They don't know how to look at something and not handle the fact that it doesn't read like they think it reads. And there's also another thing going on, right? Every one of my consistent listeners knows the basics. They know that after 15 to 20 years under a new philosophy, religion, media, true information won't mean anything. It's very rare to have someone who's interested in the truth and not their version of the truth, or how to curve fit this in their particular reading of the Old Testament and that type of thing. But it has nothing to do with what Dr. Farrell is saying. It has nothing to do with invalidating monotheism or Christianity in general, as far as the New Testament goes, because they're not talking about creating anything. They're making something. You know, the Holy One who judges all in scales is the Creator. He's the one Creator. But they're not creating anything. They're making something. And that's where it becomes provocative. But it has everything to do with National Socialism. And that's my mini diatribe or speech on that. And this is something I may go into further. But use one-stop shopping. All you have to do is get Dr. Farrell's books for $13, look at his sources, and you can read about anything you want to read about from an authority's perspective. He's good to have around, because when you're navigating the minefield of ancient languages and how to read this verse and how to read that verse, even at the seminary level, even at the seminary level, you will find that, according to him, most don't know how to do it correctly. They don't know how to get the necessary information. There's a level of pollution that's come in, and I think all Christians can agree with that. There's a level of pollution that's come in on all religions when it comes to the truth or ferrying out what this means or that means, or and that's where a lot of the different dissension has come in and a lot of different unhappiness. But this is the end of 34, and 35 is going to be out shortly after. 35 is going to, I'm going to go into 9/11. I'm going to give you my view on 9/11 because I keep asking, how come you don't talk about 9/11? Well, I'll talk about 9/11. You might, probably won't like my opinion on it, but I'll talk about 9/11. And what else am I going to? I'm going to answer some other questions I have because I have a ton of questions. But hopefully, in this last MP3, I answered maybe 100 questions. About what I thought about this or that. And we can maybe expand on it in further conversations. I'll be back with you on 35.
This is the end of another episode of Follow the White Rabbit. Follow the White Rabbit, again, is a game that will teach you practical politics. Practical politics is practical because it is non-voting, which makes it the very, very practical. Conventional politics is voting politics or rule-based politics. And the ultimate, of course, is full-spectrum practical politics, engaging and taking down an opponent, a system, by any means necessary, within the rules, within the law, but never breaking them. And this is the end of another episode of Follow the White Rabbit. Thank you for listening.